This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to Fuse, a BOM podcast. 40 years ago, BOM began as a conversation between artists around a kitchen table in downtown New York. Today, Fuse brings you into the room to listen in on candid, unfiltered conversations about creative practice. Here's how it works. BOM invites a distinguished artist to choose a guest from any creative discipline. An art crush, a close collaborator, or even a stranger they've admired from afar. And we bring them together. No host, no moderator, no interruptions. Just two artists in conversation. For this episode, we asked visual artist Shabala LaSelf who she'd most like to speak with. She selected her friend Abdu Ali, the musician and multidisciplinary artist. The pair discuss the fantasy of permanent institutional spaces, unapologetic art, and the fraught desire for canonical recognition.
When I was asked by BOM to choose an artist who I would most like to speak to, Abdu was the obvious choice. We have collaborated on many projects before, and we've been in dialogue often. And it's just been such an easy conversation and also just super transformative.
Abdu Ali is a musician, writer, cultural worker, and artist. Blending punk, jazz, Baltimore club music, and rap, their works explore ideas of race, gender, sexuality, and liberation. They received a 2018 Ruby Artist Grant and a 2019 Best Artist Award by the LGBTQ Commission of Baltimore City. Shabala LaSelf is a Harlem-born visual artist whose work concerns the emotional, physical, and psychological impact of the Black female body as icon. Her solo exhibitions include By Myself on view at the Baltimore Museum of Art and Cottonmouth at Gallery Ava Pressenhuber. Self's work is included in the collections of the Art Institute of Chicago, the Hammer Museum, and the Studio Museum in Harlem, among others.
So I guess before we met physically, we met via conversation. And for me, I feel like that's just as meaningful as meeting someone in real life, meeting people through dialogue, because as a Gemini moon and a Gemini Venus, dialogue and conversation really can affirm a lot for me as far as like how I feel about a person. And I think that interview that we had for Art Papers Magazine, when we was talking, I was like, oh, yes, okay, we clicking. Because, you know, when you're interviewing people, you never know what the vibe going to be. It might just be surface level. It might not be too intimate of a conversation. Or it might just be not too personable. But when we talked, it was just like, we met before. You know what I'm saying? It was mad, organic, natural. And I feel like we were interested in a lot of the same type of topics and theories. And, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we shared the same goals for the piece. Like, we really wanted to have, like, a serious conversation about the same subject matter. And we both wanted to facilitate one another and, like, reaching that goal. And I agree, it was totally natural, even though we had never spoken on the phone. And there's a certain level of intimacy speaking on the phone, especially with someone you never met in person before, right. But it was completely easy.
It was completely easy. And for that piece, yeah, I think it was called Body Play, and I wanted to just talk about, literally, I guess, the Black body, the Black woman's body. And I definitely, when they asked me to write something, you definitely came to mind because I was stalking you. Not stalking you, but like a huge fan.
Keeping up with each other.
Yeah, I was a huge, Huge, huge fan. And I don't remember like the moment when I first saw your work online. I do remember how I felt when I first saw your work. First of all, this is out of this world. This is very, I don't think your work speaks to Afrofuturism, but it's definitely influenced by Afrofuturism, right? No, we are the future. We is in the future now.
Well, that's what you were saying yesterday, that we are in the future right now. So that makes sense that the work, if it's about this contemporary moment, would embody Afrofuturism to some degree, because we are the Afrofuturists. If this is not the future or potentially dystopic moment that happens right after, then I don't know what else it could be right now.
Afrofuturism?
Yeah.
Yeah, when I first started doing music, I was heavily influenced by Black Star, who is a DJ and producer from Baltimore, who is a pioneer of Baltimore club music, and he worked closely with MIA on a lot of her tracks, and Diplo as well, but yeah. So his music is very just, I mean, for me, he really was able to find a way to push Baltimore Club into the future, and I don't know, just in the production in itself, just very just ethereal and melodic and rhythmatic, and he was able to turn Baltimore Club music into songs, because I think before then it was mostly just feeling like music for the club. I feel like he transmuted Baltimore club music for it to exist outside of the club arena. I was also heavily influenced by Patti Smith's first album, Radio Ethiopia, and a lot of 70s, well, a lot of artists who, you know, were really popping in the 70s, which I think for me is one of the most iconic eras of music. Because we talk about Afrofuturism, Sun Ra, Alice Coltrane, George Clinton and P-Funk, and all just like this, you know, it was this movement of funk music. It was this movement of avant-garde experimental jazz. And it was also, at the same time, I feel like the 70s was also about spiritual liberation.
Black liberation.
Black too. Liberation, women's liberation, gay liberation, all of it. And also even in the fashion, I mean, I just think, yeah, they were so trying to be in the future and like thinking about, you know, what it means to take up space culturally and creatively, like right now. They were probably thinking about what the world was going to be like in 2020 or 2021. And so, yeah, I was heavily influenced by a lot of that music when I first came out. And a bunch of other things, too. Octavia Butler, The Parables of the Sower. I was introduced to her in my senior year of college, and that's when I started making music. In the beginning of my music practice, yeah, I was definitely already influenced by Black Star Baltimore club music, because I'm from Baltimore and that's the music that I grew up to. But then I was also reading Octavia Butler, and I was also for the first time really getting into Sun Ra, Patti Smith and George Clinton and P-Funk. So yeah, I definitely am influenced by Afrofuturism.
Some days you love, some days you fall, some days you move, some days you interrupt. Some days I struggle, well, most days I struggle. I have aspirations, I really want to hustle. You know the feeling of missing your dog that's on the muzzle. Three step, I say.
How much do you think the music scene here in Baltimore shapes the culture?
I think predominantly what people have known creatively that comes out of Baltimore is the music. And we have a long, rich history of just music artists that are pioneers, really, in music coming out of here and doing amazing things. I mean, we can go all the way back to Billie Holiday, or we can talk about Adina Howard, who was randomly living in Baltimore at one point. Or we can talk about Drew Hill. Cisco is from Baltimore. Mario, but then we have like the legendary Baltimore Club DJs like Black Star and Rod Lee and DJ Technics and DJ Boomin, who were not just popping DJs in the DMV, but they was popping everywhere. And Miss Tony and K-Swift, and then Ra Ra, and then you have my era, you know, me and TT the Artist, and even Serpent with Feet and JPEG Mafia, like all these amazing artists who I feel like are really, I guess, like pushing the boundaries of sound, which to me makes sense if you grow up here and you live here. Baltimore is a very unruly city. I mean, we just always exist in this gray area. Like, we're literally between the north and the south, you know, right in the middle. And I feel like we're right in the middle of New York and D.C. So, you know, it's kind of like this underdog city, but this underdog city that has, like, a lot of flavor. And in a way, like, us kind of, not necessarily being ignored, but not, yeah, I guess being ignored and culturally and creatively kind of maybe worked in our benefit because we were able to maybe avoid being watered down like D.C. or New York.
You can exist more in the gray area. You don't have to have so much allegiance to like one particular place or region.
Yeah, because I grew up being heavily influenced by, you know, New York music, you know, Biggie, Lil' Kim, or just like, I guess the Northeast, like DMX and people like that, Tupac, but also being influenced by Southern rappers too, you know, Outkast and Goody Mob and people like that. So I feel like, yeah, us being in the middle kind of helped us be able to take different vibes from both the South and the North. You're from Harlem, right?
Yeah, I'm from Harlem.
Do you feel like, I mean, Harlem obviously has a rich culture, especially a rich history in Black art and literature and everything. Do you feel like that essence that comes out of there is influencing your work?
I feel like every aspect of my personality and my practice is shaped by where I grew up and how I grew up. I feel like in Harlem, you can find every kind of person. You know what I mean? And you can find every kind of person that also looks like you and I. So that's like a unique phenomenon. Like, it's Black people, all kind of people from like all over the world in Harlem. And that's the thing that was most exciting about it growing up. Also too, I come from like a large family. So my household was always full of people. I have four older siblings, so them and all their friends, my parents and their friends. It's a lot of different people I feel like I met when I was really, really young. And a lot of my siblings' friends, my parents' friends were artists or creatives, like writers, musicians, artists. So also having that kind of exposure. My parents enjoyed the arts, so it was something that was kind of cultivated or encouraged in me if I wanted to like pursue it. I think from like a young age, I always had an interest in it. And then when I got older and I decided it's something that I wanted to focus on, it was kind of a good place to be in, to be an artist, I guess, like New York, Harlem City. It made sense. It wasn't something that seemed like it was so impossible to do because I could look back and say, okay, I knew this person, a neighbor, a friend, and a family friend that had done something similar. So it seemed possible.
How important it is to have those influences around you at a young age to help you be able to envision the possibility of you being an artist, especially. I grew up with not maybe artists in my family too much or working artists, but definitely creative people. Like my uncle is he paints and does tattooing. I also was fortunate to grow up in schools that taught me about the legacy of Black art and literature. At an early age, I was reading Maya Angelou and James Baldwin and Toni Morrison. I was reading James Baldwin, Go Tell It on the Mountain in seventh grade, you know? And also, I grew up knowing the legacies that came up in my own community. I went to Booker T. Washington, which is the same middle school that Thurgood Marshall went to. Thurgood Marshall was from Baltimore. Or I grew up, you know, knowing that the block that I was existing on, which is Pennsylvania Avenue and MLK, was at one point a very popping cultural hub for Black creativity from the 1920s to the 1970s. And it was this infamous theater called the Royal Theater that, like, the biggest artists and black artists during those times would come through there, and you had to come through there and like do your thing, or you wasn't gonna get like the flowers that you wanted. And also, I grew up with Miss Tony, who was a Baltimore Club legend, as a celebrated cultural figure in Baltimore. And she had her own radio show, too. And she had songs that would be played all the time. And Miss Tony, it was a gender nonconforming Black gay man. And I had this a part of my childhood youth. And at the time, being young, obviously, I didn't really know what queerness or being gay was. But I think just having that person as a role model, you know, affirmed me once I was beginning my journey as a queer person, which is definitely a privilege, you know, and a blessing to have that type of representation.
Ancestors was killed because we have never accepted slavery. We had to live on what we never wanted. So we know that this flag is drenched with our blood. So what the young people are saying now, give us a chance to be young men respected as a man. As we know, this country was built on the black backs of black people across this country. And if we don't have it, you ain't gonna have it either, because we gonna tear it up. That's what they say. And people ought to understand that. I don't see why they don't understand. They know what they've done to us.
I feel like your figures are often existing in these just like white spaces, I guess. Not white as in racial, but just like color, like white.
Color fields, yeah. Or liminal space.
Yeah, but at the same time, because when I think of Harlem, I think it's just busy and like popping. You know, something's always happening, and I feel like your figures do come off like they're a part of that energy, and they're doing something. It's a lot of movement, and a lot of movement that the figures are doing in your work. I don't know, even though I guess your figures aren't in environmental spaces, it still feels very much so like they are in a space, though, especially with the movement, the lines, but also the clothes they wear and everything.
For me, it's about thinking about who the person is in terms of like their personality, maybe. So I think when you live in a city, you get accustomed to looking at people. You look at people by default because there's just like so many people around. But also, too, you look at people because you need to kind of, I guess, get your bearings in any right. situation. So you're kind of looking at people to observe them, but maybe also to get a sense of who they are or like what they are about, you know? And you want to be able to come to some kind of conclusion relatively quickly. It's just something that you take on, I think, just from like city life. So growing up in New York and then growing up in Harlem, I think I've always been accustomed to just observing people. And I find people very interesting. Like, I think I'm a huge, like, voyeur. Like, I love looking at people, how they walk, how they carry themselves, what they're wearing. And for me to make the portraits and kind of extract a person out of this, like, context, this physical or social or political context, and just place them within a liminal space, I'm almost able to like really zone in on the individual or the subject right. in the painting. And in doing that, I feel like I'm able to make the painting more about them as spiritual being, an existential being, maybe some aspect of their interiority, their mind, their desire, their emotions, as opposed to all this other information, which I feel like is relevant, but maybe not as interesting. That's one of the points of like having the figures be in these kind of environments that are devoid of like all these like markers. But then I do have other projects where the figure is very much situated within a space. Like, for example, like the Bodega Run series. And then that space is very much married to the neighborhood that I grew up in, because a bodega is something that is something that's like almost, is part of New York. And not every part of New York. It's part of a very specific kind of neighborhood in New York. In that series, I wanted to find a space that I felt was as iconic as my figures almost. Like a space that existed as like a microcosm of all dynamics in the neighborhood at large. So the space itself is symbolic, and that's why I felt like it made sense to place my figures in there. And also, I had been doing the paintings for so long with the figures in the liminal space, and I wanted to just like formally and conceptually challenge myself like within my practice and see, okay, like what would it be like? What would the effect be if the figures were in an environment? And then that environment seemed like the most plausible environment that I would encounter one of my subjects if they were real. So if, like, if I was to see one of my figures in the real life, in the real world, then I would see them at the bodega. That's what I figured. So that's kind of what site I wanted to focus on.
You was talking about information that isn't needed to be seen or that isn't interesting.
Not like as interesting.
Well, like what? Like, can you give an example?
Okay, I can place one of my figures in an environment, right? But in doing that, I would have to give some information to the viewer generally about, okay, is this an exterior space or an interior space? What is the time period in which the space is occurring? What are they wearing? Now that they're in reality, what kind of clothing are they wearing? If they're not wearing clothing, they go from being nude to naked or naked to nude. It has all these different connotations. Whereas if I can just take all that away or strip all that away, now I'm thinking about the body as being the site. So the body itself is the site of action as opposed to this locale that the body is within. And I feel like by naming the body as the site, you're pointing to the fact that the individual that is within that body, the natural experience of that body is merely a vessel for another experience, an existential, spiritual experience, potentially a psychological, emotional experience, potentially. So by naming the body as the site, you're able to have much more interesting conversations about desire and the mind and spirituality. Whereas if you name the site itself a location and the bodies within it, now you're talking about the systems that control the site, right, the environment. And those systems are political and social. And those are systems which I don't fully believe in the validity of. So for me to make a work about it, I would have to somehow concede to engage in a conversation about it.
Right, because, you know, I was going to say that your work definitely does a good job at not centering the white gaze.
Yeah, I have no desire to do so. And it doesn't edify me any kind of way to do that. So any kind of workaround I can find to avoid that, I try. And one of the workarounds is to talk about the figure as itself alone, like not within the larger system of like society or nation or place or site.
So when it comes to your sculptural figures, how do you tend to do that type of work in a gallery space? Because, you know, traditionally gallery spaces are like co-opted by whiteness and white people. So how do you go about like trying to not center the white gaze with your cultural pieces in the gallery or in a museum?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I'm still contending with. I can't sincerely say that I've fully like solved that issue. But I do think about organizing and the sculptures play into this. I think about when I'm having a show, creating some kind of environment in which the figure, it appears to be the environment appears to be owned by the figures, and trying to change the power dynamic so it doesn't appear as if the figures are there on display or there to perform for the audience. And so by having sculptures like inside the exhibition space, so having artworks that are not on the wall but actually within the exhibition space, and having viewers need to like negotiate moving around them or having viewers see that the works are now in the space itself, like taking up space, right, not just on the wall, but in the actual space that they are meant to occupy. I feel like it's kind of pushing for the agency, right, of the subjects.
Versus putting the figures on display or putting them like on a podium or like a situated stage.
Yeah, I want the viewer to feel as if they're entering into the space of the work, not that the work is there for them.
Like a zoo or something.
And, you know, a zoo is like a good thing to bring up, because I feel like a lot of times in which when people feel farther marginalized within these institutional spaces, that's the feeling that they're pointing to, the feeling that they're on display, you know, that they're there for a pseudo-anthropological reason, like how a zoo functions.
Your figures are, like you said, they're kind of like spiritual entities, I guess, or energy entities. And with that being said, their shapes or like the outlinings of their bodies isn't, I guess, scientifically like human bodies or whatever. But I feel like also it's kind of like a secret code like that only Black people would know how to crack spiritually, you know, and whether it be consciously or subconsciously. I started laughing in my head like as you were talking, because I was just like, obviously your work is genius and there's no doubt in that. You are like a legend in the making, right? I just thought about like a white person buying your painting. I'm not saying white people can't be true fans of your work or my work, but sometimes I feel like this too when I perform, you know, especially when I was in Europe and like I perform in mostly predominantly like white spaces or like with white audiences. Like, even though they feeling it, like I can also feel the energy. They probably like, what is this? Because, which I love, because I don't care for you to figure it out, right? But you can adore the work and champion the work and love it and bestow, you know, support and et cetera. But at the same time, like, I do want to leave a lot of pieces of it just for me and my people.
There's a surface level understanding that the masses attach themselves to. Then there's like a deeper, like esoteric meaning that people who are either literally or figuratively initiated into the true meaning of the religion, like understand. And exactly. Everything exists like that. I mean, all systems, I think, exist like that, even systems that are secular. So I definitely feel like that exists in my work. And I do wonder, too, like, why people have, like, a compulsion to, like, buy or own art. Like, I wonder that because that's not my position in this, like, system. I make the work. But I think if people want to own work or have work because they feel like by doing so they have ability to, like, own a part of, like, history or mm-hmm. culture or society or own the part of the world that is intangible, that we all feel but none of us can see or touch. So they think that somehow through owning art, they are now in possession of that. Like, they'd be able to turn mm-hmm. that intangible feeling into something physical. So mm-hmm. I think the artists have that desire too, and that's why they make work. They produce mm-hmm. art objects or music or performance. They're hoping to put in some kind of physical form our natural beings can interact with. That part that is spiritual, potentially, you know? People who, I think, desire to collect them, those objects or those bits and pieces, I think they're wanting to, like, hold on to it, possess it. I think they feel like there's power in it. And I believe there is.
It definitely is. And I think, you know, intention behind anything is something to examine. And I think that's why you're hearing now so many Black artists today talk about the importance of Black art buyers and Black people buying each other's work, or Black people in general buying Black art, and also having your work acquired by Black institutions and Black galleries and Black museums, which is really rare in America. And yeah, but at the same time, I guess, like, I don't know, me and my friend, a mutual friend of ours, we got into it about like, would you allow a museum to buy your work? And I was like, fuck no, I wouldn't. Like, fuck the museum, this and that. And it was like, well, I want my work to be acquired by a museum because I need my shit to, you know, have legacy. I need to last. And I feel like, you know, they wasn't agreeing with, like, museum practices and nothing like that. But they was just talking about the importance of, I guess, their work being preserved for, like, generations and generations.
Yeah, they're probably thinking about the practical elements of it, like it being preserved, it being documented, mm-hmm. being safe, it being on view to the public. Because mm-hmm. when private individuals have the work, who knows how many people will actually experience the work, right. You know, whereas if an institution has it, you're thinking, oh, hundreds, thousands of people.
Right. But I'm also coming from the positionality of being a music artist and being a performer, where a lot of times I feel like the real, like, work that I do, which I feel like I'm a performer before I'm a recording artist.
Yeah, I can attest to that after seeing you perform live.
Thank y'all. And I feel like I was maybe more on the side of, you know, fuck a museum acquiring my work, because I'm like, as a performer, the work that I do is ephemeral, and I'm okay with that. And it, for me, it's an energy thing, and it's going to exist literally in the chakras or the vibrations of the receiver. And maybe, you know, that energy is going to be carried through generations if they have children, this and that. I'll be thinking of some, like, wild shit, you know, when it comes to that. So for me, I don't care if my, like, necessarily if my work, like if any of my music or my performances or whatever isn't preserved for eternally, I'm okay with it dying.
It's all a fantasy anyway, to think that something will last forever. So the institutions, you know, function off this collective agreement or belief that everything will go on as it has, which everyone knows that's not possible, for one. At some point, all of it will be gone. I'm not saying we're going to be around for that point. You should even think about it. It could be very, very far. It could be a point far, far in the future. Yeah, I mean, it's not, none of it is going to be around forever. Nothing lasts forever. You know, people are just trying to hold on for as much as they can get.
You know? Okay, when I mean like physically lasting, I mean lasting forever, I'm thinking about physically, right? Because I feel like the work that we produce can last internally, but through frequency and through energy and consciousness.
I think that museums are a bit about posterity, but I think they also are about people feeling like there's a certain level of, I guess, prestige or validation by getting the canon right. to recognize you. And I understand both sides of the argument. I understand how it could be subversive, right, to say, okay, now I'm here. But I also understand the perspective when people say, by even arguing to have a seat at the table, you are conceding that the table is of any relevance.
Unless you're playing Robin Hood, and I think that's what we need to be doing.
But how many people do that? Because that's why I love Holy Mountain. You have, remember the level right before the top? Where a lot of people, that was like the bacchanal, like the party and the wine and the grapes. And a lot of people on their way to the top of the mountain, they get stuck right there. They think that that's the top, the party. And if you get stuck in that part, you're never going to make it to the top of the mountain. You're damn sure never going to walk back down. So a lot of people get caught up in the revelry of the acknowledgement and the accolades. So the idea that you're going to be the Robin Hood, you might be seduced by the whole system before you become Robin Hood. It might be too comfortable to think, okay, now that I'm going to not go back. That's what I think what happens sometimes. That's why I think people are skeptical.
In my green Suzuki hatchback, never looking back through the battlefields of Baltimore, where you can't afford to be no whore. You gotta be more than a nigga. I'm Mansa Musa, more than a nigga. My heart beats like the jazz of Coltrane. Oh, listen to how it says. I be the color of purple haze. Flesh is thorns, best to protect my soul. It's magical. I'm an old man with a enormous ways, I'm enormous. Yes, I'm a title, feeling so damn gorgeous. Fraudness is the performance, the life I live. Provoke me to be this bitch. I'm this bitch.
Yeah. Some people truly just are not built for that. And you don't want to recruit people who don't want to participate. Because what they're going to do is just sabotage the whole movement out of resentment or just a lack of care, you know? If you feel like you want to participate in that kind of movement or discussion, and you feel like that's something that is important to you, then you should do it without fear or hesitation. But if you don't feel coerced into participating, because if you do participate, it's not going to be wholehearted. It's probably going to do more harm than good, in my opinion. But I do think that if you are a Black person, if you are like any kind of person that comes from a community or from like who shares identity politic that has generally been made to feel marginalized, that if you're able to find a way to escape like a system that is generally meant to like erase you or to harm you or to destroy you, if you're able not to be destroyed or harmed or made smaller, then you are, in a way, too, still fighting, even if you're not centering the fight as a whole, like within your practice or your daily life.
And if you're able to just make work unapologetically, that's unapologetic and autonomous in a way that doesn't allow, you know, white influences, Western influences, or Eurocentric influences. Yeah, I feel like then you're resistance, like in the pursuit of resistance as well.
I agree. But also too, like some of those things that we think are European or Eurocentric, they're also ours as well. Especially being here, like especially being American, Black American, like anything that has to do with this nation is ours, that right. we have full access to, we have full ownership to, is we have full birthright to.
Right. Mm. So what are some things that you are interested in exploring and investigating these days?
I mean, there's so many. I think I want to kind of look at different ways of working, like different mediums. I'm also still interested in creating more new avenues to talk about Black life and to talk about the quotidian in a way that's exciting and fresh. I had a conversation recently, too, with another person. They were asking me, like, do you think everyone's work is about their identity? Or they were proposing that some people's work was about identity, but others wasn't. But I'm under the impression that everyone's work is about their own identity. I mean, it's logical, isn't it?
Yeah.
How could it not be?
How could it not be? And the whole gag is that I think white people need to start making work more about their identity.
It would be okay? healing, I think.
Yes. And it's like, you know, because there's this conversation, like, you know, around like Black artists, like we only don't have to speak about Blackness and Black, you know, the Black experience and this and that. And I think for me, that sentiment is a little anti-Black, because I'm here about being all Blackity, Black all the time. Okay. It's, you know, I was fortunate again to grow up like learning the legacy behind Black art, literature, his like law, all of it, right? But a lot of people, a lot of Black folk in America didn't have that privilege, don't have that privilege. So I feel like, because I heard this one artist before, a Black artist who was just like, you know, you know, I understand like this is moving for like young Black creators and artists to just indulge in just like, you know, the Black archives and Black history and Black literature and only consume Black content. And he was trying to suggest that Black artists should also engage in white make content, literature, art, etc., to have, I guess, a balanced view. And I was just like, excuse me, that's all we've been growing up to all our lives. So if, as young Black artists, if we want to just get into just everything Black, all Black every day, then I feel like that's plausible, because most of us grew up in academic institutions that do nothing but that. Because even though I did grow up with consuming Black create like Black literature, art, etc., history, that was maybe still only 40-30% of what I was learning in school, you know, because most of it was, you know, your Shakespeare's and, you know, your Emily Dickinson's and stuff like that. So I just feel like, yeah, it's okay for us to just, you know, consume nothing but Black art, because so much of it has been ignored, erased, and just not taught. And I'll never forget in this documentary with Sonia Sanchez, and she was talking about how when she first moved to New York and she went to the Schomburg and she went in the library and she found all the, you know, all this archives of Black art, literature, music, everything, and she said she started weeping.
How can you be Black and creative in 2019 and not be taken advantage of? That's the real question. It's a real fucking question. I look and I see all these different people, all these different things. And I wonder to myself, like, how am I gonna end up, you know, as a Black creator? I wonder, man, between the dick riders, the niggas that hate, the niggas that want to see you die for no fucking reason, it's just like, it doesn't seem like there's a way out for people like us, like, I don't know, man, it's very sad.
If you're not talking about your own experience in your work or your, you know, your identity, then what the hell is you talking about? Or if you're not thinking about your, because you can be talking about physics and nature and this and that, but we are that too, you know?
I just don't believe that anyone's work is not about their lived experience. I just, like, I feel like that is complete falsehood that's been perpetuated. It needs to end.
Okay, I feel like white artists are maybe in that category. A lot of white artists are in that category. When, well, we're not going to talk about music. I'm just talking about visual art, I guess, where their work isn't really unless they're like white and queer or white and lesbian trans, like that, I feel like I tend to see them talk about their identity and their work. Okay, I'll just say that. I think they do need to start talking about whiteness more.
Well, I think if something's omitted, right, that is as important as what's said. So if your work appears to be devoid of any kind of social or political commentary, that also is a reflection of your lived experience. Your lived experience is devoid of any social or political commentary. So that alone will point to any other person that has a different lived experience that that's possibly your background. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just do the whole psychoanalysis thing on Black artists and their work. That has to be applied to everybody.
Right. Exactly, exactly. And that's what it is.
Also, I feel like it would be far more productive for the arts community and for people in general if people just let go of this idea that, you know, identity politics don't affect everyone. It's burdensome even to the people who are made to feel as if they are, you know, human, everyone else is X, Y, and Z kind of person.
I wanted to talk to you about collaboration because this whole podcast is celebrating that and artists being fans of each other. And I feel like, honestly, I mean, I do think that we need to collaborate more, not just me and you, but the collective. And I feel like, in a way, it's ironic that we are more, I think, in conversation, or we know about, a lot of us know about each other via Instagram or social media, but I feel like a lot of us aren't taking the effort to collaborate in real life. I feel like, for the most part, you know, when you think about the Black arts community, let's just say in the East Coast, I feel like a lot of us are the homies, we are friends, we in conversation, but I think something is not, hasn't clicked where we're like, oh, we need to make work together. Because when you think, I think about the Black arts movement, I think about, I don't know, even with Black writers like Sonia Sanchez and Nikki Giovanni and Toni Morrison, they was all hanging out with each other, making work with each other, performing with each other, etc. Yeah, I feel like there's not only fun in collaboration, but also there's something that could come out of that that's very enriching and, like, you know, new and nuanced.
And what you were saying, too, about the void of Black institutions, if Black collaboration could lead towards the building or the support of those kinds of institutions. So it's important for many reasons why people are in conversation with one another, hold space with one another, and have trust and community with one another, because that goes towards building infrastructure and towards organizing towards systems and spaces that can facilitate things for Black youth or be more equitable spaces for other Black creatives.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think that when you talk about organizing, I think maybe that's what I'm also speaking to, is organized movement, I guess, within the Black art space. And you're starting to see that. You have Arts.Black. You have, well, my whole platform, As They Lay, is about that, too. My last album, Fire, was influenced by Fire, the Leray zine. Yeah, from the Harlem Renaissance, with Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes, Wallace Thurman, Richard Nugent, Aaron Douglas, you know, a legendary crew. And going back to collaboration, see what I'm saying? I just feel like, it's so ironic in this technological age that we in. We're not, I feel like they were back in the day collaborating way more than what we are doing now.
I mean, it is worth thinking about, and maybe the community as a whole should ask themselves, why isn't it happening? And if people agree that it could be something that's beneficial to everyone, how can we facilitate for it to happen, you know?
I think individualism is why it's not happening.
I mean, I agree, but individualism is what's causing a lot of issues as of late. Even think about the whole chaos of this whole past year. That has a lot to do with just this culture of individualism. Beyond individualism, or maybe it's tied into it, I think it's like, you know, ego and maybe youth or things like that. Maybe it's something that will happen more in the future. Maybe it's something that people will organically, like, fall into, you know?
Kwame Ture once said that individualism is a luxury you can no longer afford. And that's what I feel like we really got to put that into practice, that whole sentiment. But I was saying about the history of Black publications, Fire, the Afro, the Black Panthers. They had their own publication. The Conjee River Collective. Even Toni Morrison book, The Black Book.
There's power in media, especially when it comes to images of Black people.
Okay, media is the fourth branch of government, okay?
True. So the fact that you're saying that there exists no media outlet that's for Black artists specifically, that's definitely a need. And you can see how that could, the lack of something like that could cause a void in terms of perspective and content. So I completely agree with you.
We need more publication, we need more collaborations, and we need more spaces for critique.
That is a whole other thing.
I mean, what is the other thing, honey?
I don't know. I mean, okay, we need more diversity, for one, within the Black critique system, because there is some level of tokenism that exists within that system right now.
And academic or intellectual elitism.
Yes, 100%. And sometimes I feel like just because someone's Black doesn't necessarily mean they understand your perspective. They might be extremely reactionary, or they might be, you know, just mimicking some kind of perspective they feel is the appropriate one in regards to understanding your work that actually could be anti-Black or anti-anything else that encompasses your identity. So it needs to be just more voices out there so that when you're Black and they want to get a Black perspective, they don't keep going back to the same five people.
And you know, when I think about Black critique or nourishing Black critique and helping Black artists elevate, I definitely think about Studio Museum in Harlem. And I think that we need more, not necessarily just Black museums, but like Black residencies.
There are more Black patrons of the arts, that people who have been either pushed out or ignored previously by, I guess, the brokers that manage all like the moving and the selling of work. More Black people have entered into that system or those dynamics, and they're buying more Black art. Black people are becoming more interested in having and holding and preserving Black art for future Black generations. And I feel like the Black institutions that have survived and who are here today standing strong, places like the Schomburg and the Studio Museum, I think that you're going to see other institutions that are going to feel motivated and inspired by those spaces and, you know, at least try to start to build something that can one day amount to that level of importance, you know, within the arts community. Yeah, like something like the Schomburg, it kind of goes in and out of the arts community. It's not just art, it's everything. It's culture within the cultural community as a whole.
Well, I think that Black creative sanctuaries is going to have to play multiple roles, you know, definitely. And can't just be a space to exhibit art. It has to be a community center, a library, you know, maybe also a space for mutual aid, like all these things. And I think that's another thing to think about. And this is something that I want to, you know, do as someone who considers themselves a cultural worker, is to think about what it means for creative spaces or art spaces to be more community oriented. And how do we democratize those spaces so that everyone feels welcome and comfortable to come and exist in those spaces? I actually began my practice in Buddhism recently, and one of my first it wasn't specifically for Black Buddhists, but it was mostly Black Buddhists there. And one of my first classes or workshops practicing mindfulness and Buddhism, you know, this idea of rest came up, you know, and Black people rest and this and that, and how you really gotta, you know, kind of reprogram your body to not always be in a reactionary state and mode, and how mindfulness can help your body truly, be in a restful state or in a non-reactionary state, even in times of hardship or like when you are approached by very violent situations. I definitely try to take pride, you know, I pride myself in, you know, I ain't pressed to be about productivity. I'm going to chill. That's when that Taurus energy comes out. I'm going to chill. I'm going to watch anime and I'm going to get stoned and drink a glass of wine, take a bubble bath, you know what I'm saying? Do my face mask, this and that. But, you know, in that class, I really had to think about, as we all was talking about, what it means to rest. I'm like, have I ever truly rested? Am I rest? And what it means to really, you know, work in the spirit of abundance and not scarcity. And this is something that I thought I was doing, but I have to realize that it's not something you just be like, okay, now I'm gonna work in the spirit of abundance. You really have to kind of reprogram your body and your mind and everything to start working in that spirit of abundance, because for so long I've been working in survival mode, even though I think I work smarter and not harder. And I still feel like, you know, I'm still kind of in survival mode. So, you know, I'm thinking about creating a music project for meditation and in the pursuit of mindfulness. And I think moving forward, my work, especially for music, is going to be more, I guess, about the ideologies that I want to pursue, and not necessarily like how I want to just navigate this world as a Black, queer, gender nonconforming person. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to get into that bag, and I just got to work through my anxiety.
Yeah, we all do. That's a first step.
Right. So, yeah, you know, that's what I got going on coming up next.
Well, Abdu, it's been a pleasure to reconnect with you and to see you in person.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course.
Thank you, Ball Magazine, for hosting this. And we signing out.
Fuse is produced by Libby Flores, associate publisher at BOM. It is edited and engineered by Will Smith, with production assistance by Josh Dassa. I'm Chantal McStay, associate editor at BOM Magazine. Our theme music is Black Origami by Jalen. This project is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, on the web at arts.gov. Subscribe to Fuse on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.